Today's guest is a big believer in stories and their value to us as humans. Todd Davies lives in Southern Oregon and will appear at Southern Oregon University tomorrow at 4 at the Hannon Library talking about the importance of stories. Todd Davies works in just about any medium that involves writing, meaning any medium. She's been a writer, producer, actor, and graphic designer on several movies and TV series. That includes a writing credit for Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas with Johnny Depp. Todd Davies is the founder of Exterminating Angel Press, supporting practical solutions for creative idealists. Todd, good to have you on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the founding of Exterminating Angel. Is it a response to old tired stories?
It's actually the name of a movie that was made in the 50s by the surrealist director, Louis Buñuel. Do you want the plot?
Sure.
Really fast?
Yeah,
okay.
That's great. It's just people stuck in a house.
Okay, so, yeah, that's right. It's a whole bunch of upper class people before the opera having a dinner party, and then they can't leave the house, and there's no reason. They go to the door, the fire department comes to the door and says, we'll get you out. And they say, help, help, help. They can't get out. So hijinks ensue, you know, the usual cannibalism. cannibalism, adultery, the usual. And then in the morning, just as easily as they couldn't leave the house, they can leave the house. The entire town goes into a church to give Thanksgiving, and nobody can leave the church. And that's the end of the movie. So the motto of Exterminating Angel Press is, just go out the door.
Is that a message to people to just get started?
It's a message about story, really. If you think you're trapped, you're not. Just go out the door. Don't you love that in fairy tales when all of a sudden a door appears and you just open it?
Right.
And there you are.
There's something there.
It's there's
like,
something.
Okay.
Oh, a new world.
Take chances. How long have you been writing your whole life?
Yes. Yes, I have been writing my whole life to my mother's despair. I think she made me promise I wouldn't write about her when I was 5. So I have to say I've broken that promise, but since she doesn't read what I write, it's all right.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about stories, though, one of the messages that I get from the website from Exterminating Angel Press is it shouldn't be so much about economics. Everything seems to get down to dollars for a lot of things. But you're just talking about just make good stories. Just put stuff out there.
Oh, definitely. Well, I mean, that's why I'm a huge proponent of there being a minimum income, because I think that we're losing an awful lot of creativity, which we need, by the way. Flag, flag, flag. We need more creativity now than we have needed, I don't know, probably in the years that America's been going. And we're only going to get it from people who are investigating their own stories and expressing them. So they need time to do that. So please do that, all of you out there.
So the beginning of Exterminating Angel itself, did it go in a somewhat different direction from what you might have anticipated?
Well, actually, I don't know that I anticipated anything. The reason why I formed it was I was a film producer and a social activist in England, of all places. And I had a project.
Because your husband's from England, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he's a film director, and I was his producer and his writer. And we were based in Liverpool, which they used to tell me at the Medford Airport I was the only person who commuted from Medford to Manchester. And I was, too. And let me tell you, you can't do it now.
Really?
You can't do it now. No. I mean, this was before all the TSA stuff. Mm-hmm. You could actually leap on the plane 15 minutes before and get an upgrade, but you can't do it now. So it would kill me now. It killed me then. I literally went back and forth between the Rogue Valley and Liverpool 6 times a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But I mean, it was okay because you could get upgrades and they'd actually give you a bottle of wine at the end. Well, they liked us,
uh-huh.
You know, because they saw
sure.
us so often. So, but anyway, I was a social activist and I started a project to get kids back into education through making their own television programs in one of the most deprived neighborhoods in Europe, actually. And the project started, there was no way to get it where we wanted it to go. We wanted the community to own it, but we couldn't seem to manage that. It just kept moving to the usual hierarchy of people from London coming in and taking charge. And so I came home to try and figure out what had gone wrong. And what had gone wrong was that there were no stories to tell us what to do next. The only story was the great white man has to come in and then save the neighborhood. That was the only story anyone had. So I thought, you know what? Let's go to the story level and see what happens here. So I started the press online mainly because I didn't tell anybody it was going to be a publishing company, mainly because I didn't want a sudden influx of people who just wanted to be published no matter what, because it was only me and who could take that. And I found a whole group of people who were interested in the same things and started publishing those books and publishing stories about that. Actually, the initial idea has been getting more refined as we've gone on. We more and more realize that stories can be visionary and that stories need to be visionary right now. There's a really great Oregon writer, Walida Emerisha, who coined the phrase.
We've talked to her, yeah.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
She coined the phrase visionary fiction. I mean, I tracked her down because I was so impressed with that.
Mm-hmm.
And what had been really depressing me about modern fiction was that it was mainly just adult fiction, what we call adult fiction, literary fiction, was mainly dystopian, was mainly about how messed up the world is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's fine, and there is a place for that. But right now, we need some visions of how things could be different, perhaps. So
something about a better future, something about a
that would be nice
utopian rather than dystopian world.
Well, I don't like to say utopian because that sounds kind of like cotton wax.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it sounds kind of awful. A nice woman named Stephanie Raffalock out there suggested transformative mm-hmm. fiction, which is just the idea of how we are going to transform what's happening right now into something, the next stage. There's definitely going to be a next stage. We hope it's going to be better than some predictions.
So why do you suppose the literary machine, and I'm talking about not just in book pages, but certainly on the movie screens, that you go look at any action kind of movie and you're going to see all these gray skies and cloudy looking things and horrible looking futures. It seems to make money. Is that why it keeps getting made?
Well, it's definitely why it keeps. It's not the only reason why it keeps getting made, though.
Go ahead. Yeah, you got it.
So,
few seconds left.
It's also what people expect and what people see. Because the other thing is, you can only see what you believe. And if you've got an entire culture that is leaning toward only believing that things are going to get worse, that's all you're going to see. That's
right.
The shrinks have a name for it. They call it negative hallucination, where you can't see something that's right in front of you because you don't believe in it.
Okay, much more to explore there. We're talking to Todd Davies about the importance of stories. She'll be giving a session about that tomorrow at the Hannon Library at Southern Oregon University. We'll come back and talk more with her and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on The Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Todd Davies, who, it turns out, has been writer, producer, actor, and novelist, but not graphic designer. IMDb, shame on you, but shame on me for picking up on it. But Todd Davies does know a lot about stories and their telling and is the creator of Exterminating Angel Press. She lives near Ashland and doesn't travel six times a year to Manchester quite anymore. Thank God, she says. She'll be talking about the importance of story tomorrow at 4 at the Hannon Library at the Southern Oregon University campus. You can join us now at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So I'm really intrigued by what you talked about just before the break, where we tend to think of dystopian futures because we just don't think the future is going to be that great. And so are you necessarily advocating a happier place or just a place that's not automatically grim?
Both. A place that's more equitable. I don't think it's because we want an unhappy future. Let me just say that the way it seems to me when I read a lot of literary fiction presently, and also when I see a lot of movies, what I'm really reminded of is a teenage boy going, the world is horrible. The world is going to be horrible. Love doesn't exist. Now, what? Read that too. I'm really scared about what's going to happen next. No one's going to love me. And I really feel that when I read this stuff, when I read stuff that says everybody's out for themselves. Nobody ever wants to help anybody else. There's going to be a horrible upheaval and then zombies are going to come eat my blood. I just always think, teenage boy, it's like we're going through teenage boys and teenage girls. Okay.
For all our teenage boy listeners.
Yeah. Sorry, you guys. But trust me, someone will love you. It's okay. But that's what I start thinking about is that we're going through like a cultural phase like that, and that perhaps we should expand our vision of truth and our vision of reality, which we can. I mean, that's what always happens, is whatever vision we have is a temporary one that we then grow into the next one, just like you do in your own life, just the like way you've been doing since you were a baby.
But it's really interesting you put it in terms of teenage boys, because when you think about it, the movie industry is geared to teenage boys. Those
yes.
are the ones who they want to get in the seats and spend some money on popcorn, take a date out, all that sort of stuff. I mean, everything is geared to that opening weekend with a lot of teenage boys in the seats.
Yeah, and you know, they're really having problems too. They're having major problems. I mean, it's not happening the way it used to happen. It's not growing, which is, you know, happening in a lot of areas economically right now.
Indeed. So let's talk about the stuff that you put out at Exterminating Angel Press. I mean, you're not shy about subject matter. When you have a title like Correcting Jesus, that certainly is going to get you some attention.
It did, too.
Well, tell us about that book. I know it's not one you wrote, but you certainly...
Oh, no, I love that writer, Brian Griffith. He's fantastic. He is an independent historian. I found him, actually, because I had found a book that he had written originally in a footnote in another book I was reading, and I ordered it off Amazon, and it came in, and it had such a horrible cover that I just... put it on the bottom of the thing. And then I read it, and it was phenomenal. It was about how the story of the Garden of Eden had gotten changed and how we moved away from a Neolithic farming community to essentially a community of hierarchy. So I got in touch with him, and I said, I want you to write me a book because what I'm interested in is how stories change and how stories change our view of reality. And he said, well, what I've always wanted to do is I've always wanted to write about not correcting Jesus, but correcting the story of Jesus, how the story of Jesus got corrected over the centuries and by who and who benefited from it. And I said, go, go, go. So he did. We published it. It's found its audience in the – our books usually do. It usually takes a while for them to find their audience because they're usually so new. But I'll never forget we did a Barnes & Noble special, ebook special, and – All of a sudden, it got pummeled with things saying, if you buy this book, Correcting Jesus, you're going to go to hell. We sold 2,500 copies in one day because people were going, I have too many books, but if I'm going to hell, I'm buying this book. So that was a good lesson for me.
It's great to have you here today talking about how stories change over time, though, because it reminds me of the discussion we had yesterday with a historian who just finished this major volume on Elizabeth I, and he went to the original archival material. He was like taking the train from London to Brussels to dig into these ancient things, these letters that Elizabeth I had written herself in her own hand.
Wow.
And he pointed out that what happens often in histories, particularly when you've got somebody hundreds of years before you, is the people who write the later histories go back to the first histories, and they're not always correct.
That's right.
And he went back to the archival material. So another way in which stories change over time.
That's right. And you also have to think what was written at her time was going to be flattering as hell because they wanted to move their careers on.
Right.
I mean, you have to be thinking about this stuff. You really do. And think about this stuff when you're watching a movie, too. Why are they saying this to me? Why is this story happening like this? Think about it when you read. Think about what stories you're telling and why you're telling them like that, because what you're doing is you're framing your reality every day. We are a story-making animal. We make stories the way bees make honey, and that's how we make our reality, and that's why they're so important.
So is the problem that too many people make stories that other people have already made or just sort of take the old stories and twist them a little bit?
No, I think that's a wonderful thing.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you should definitely do that, and I think we need to go back to myths, legends, fairy tales, especially fairy tales. And one thing that we have to get over, I think, is feeling embarrassed if we like myths, legends, fairy tales, tales of the saints. I mean, this is where we came from.
It's okay to like Frozen?
It's okay. I give you permission. So, fairy tales are a very good case in point. Fairy tales are actually a biological expression of human desires over the centuries, and we do not want to lose sight of that as we march into the brilliant technological robot future.
With zombies. Don't forget the zombies.
Yeah, don't forget the zombies. I think that's what the zombies are, actually. I mean, I think zombies are like an unconscious expression of terror at the fact that our brains are getting sucked out with this idea that we're all going to turn into artificial intelligence and robots in the future and not be human anymore.
Wow. There's always something to think about talking to you, huh? Todd Davies is our guest on
so
The Exchange.
Polite.
You can join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Ron in Eugene. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hello, yeah, this is Ron. My question is, just before the break, you were talking about you cannot understand what you do not believe, and how does that, without getting into political commentary, how does that play into what we see going on with the political dramas today? And I'll take my answer up there.
All right. Thanks for that, Ron. Appreciate it. So, wow, the context of the current, let's say, the presidential campaign.
Well, I mean, I think that's a really, it's obviously on everyone's mind right now. And what it is you're looking at competing stories. You're looking at the way stories are being framed. Everybody's looking at the same situation. Everybody's looking at the fact that we all think we're going in the wrong direction. We're framing different stories about what that means. So in that sense, that's where it comes from. I have found that arguing with people about their story does not work. It just does not work. It makes people dig their heels in more about their story. What you always want to do is you want to listen to the other person's story and open yourself to it. Because when you've opened yourself to it, they have opened themselves to you as well, and your story will flow into them, and it will go back and forth and form what we hope is another story, more creative.
What was it you had said? I noticed it was in a piece in the Oregonian from 5 years ago. You'd said something like, our culture has reached a dead end.
Wow, your research is intense. Do you have time to do all of this?
Not much, but yeah.
Gosh, yeah. Well, and you know, it's funny, when I used to give speeches years ago, and I would say, our culture has reached a dead end, I would look out in the audience and people would be going, hippie, hippie. And now when I say it, everyone in the audience is looking at me aghast and nodding. I think everybody has, between climate change, between the fact that we are economically going in a different direction, we are hitting the wall of our belief that we can have permanent growth. And a lot of our stories are about how we can have permanent growth. And I think that all you have to do is have common sense to realize you cannot have permanent growth. You can't have it in your life. How can you have it as a culture? The culture is just accumulation of all of our lives. So we need new stories, which are about the joy of what we do have and what can we have, which I would like to see it be more lateral. I would like to see growth spread out rather than going straight up to the stars. You know, I'd like to make this world a nicer one than moving to Mars, personally.
Right. We wouldn't have to leave this one. You've your own books coming out of Exterminating Angel Press. They're the two jam books, which are, you can kind of call them cookbooks, but not quite. And then three published already on the history of Arcadia and a fourth on the way. Let's talk about the Arcadia books. The first of them, Snotty Saves the Day. Did not make up this title. Was there an influence? Was there something else that Snotty came to you from? I mean, I know that the whole story is about these being delivered from Arcadia, which is another world, another universe.
Actually, it's interesting because the story did, I mean, I hope, let me try and shorten this story. I hope that it came also partially because of my love for Ashland and for the Rogue Valley, which was when I was commuting back and forth to Liverpool. And I was working with at-risk kids over there. One of the kids, it wasn't one of my kids, but it was in the newspaper that a 12-year-old boy had just been arrested because he had been running a drug ring in Wales since he was 10 years old, of eight adults. And the only reason that they caught him was because his mother reported him missing 6 months after he stopped coming home. So they put him in prison, and I went to the cop, because I knew all the cops in Liverpool, and I said, let me talk to this kid, because do you know what you've done? This is a kid who could have solved every problem that you've got in England. A kid that could run eight adults in Wales from age 10, and you've put him in jail? This is a waste of resources. And they wouldn't let me see him because he was underage and blah, blah, blah. So he was the inspiration. And I would come back to Ashland and everything looked like Toy Town. It all looked so happy. So I was thinking, how would you change the world, the neighborhood that kid lived in, into a world like this, which would then have its own problems? But then how would you expand out the idea of happiness and of joy for a larger group of people, to a larger group of people? Is it even possible? And so that's where those fairy tales came from, is my experimenting with that.
Snotty earns his name. He's a bit of an anti-hero.
He's a horrible kid. But that was the point. Also, I think one of the things that I really believe is that from the smallest, from the most undiscovered, from the most scorned thing will usually come the next phase in the culture.
So when you create a story or an element within the story, is it simply what's coming out of your brain at the time, or is it also, are you thinking about the audience that will read it or see it on the movie screen?
Well, I mean, you always think about the audience, because this is a partnership between any kind of art is a partnership between the artist and the viewer. I mean, it's interactive. It is not, I really do not believe in that genius artist thing who then presents the stuff from on high and everybody admires them. I think that's complete garbage. But I have to say that the Arcadia book, I mean, it's just me talking. And it's also, when I talk, it's not coming from my brain. I mean, it kind of gets mediated through the brain, but really it's coming from somewhere else. I mean, I hear all these characters talking to me, and I race immediately to write it down, and then I fit it into the framework.
The ostensible creator of Snotty, the voice of the person who delivered the stories to you, as the story goes, writes that technical works do not travel well, but stories do, which is really fascinating.
And I think it's probably really true.
Well, so is it just me or a lot of people talking about stories right now? I ask this because we've had a couple of chats with people from medical schools who are talking about the importance of of doctors being able to tell a good narrative to a patient and also to be able to listen for the patient's story coming back. So even in realms that we consider uber technical, we're getting into a realm of like, tell me a story.
I think that that's, well, like I said, we are storytelling animals and we have to remember that we are human and that we need to cater to, not cater to, but we need to provide for human desires and human needs. One of the things I'm really going to get into in the talk tomorrow is the split between science and art, which happened around the 1850s, surprisingly. Did you know that the word scientist didn't exist before 1849?
I did not.
I know. Frankenstein, for example, Victor Frankenstein in Mary Shelley's book, which was written in 1816, by the way, in May of 1816, 200 years ago.
Wow.
That's right.
Happy anniversary, Frankenstein.
I know, and it's a great book. Victor Frankenstein is never referred to as a scientist. He's a natural philosopher. When he goes off to school, he goes off to philosophy school. It didn't happen for about 30 years until science pulled itself away from art. Art is about, science has been spectacularly successful since the 1840s in doing the how do we do things? But art has always been about why do we do things? And science, I think, and I hope, is starting to rejoin with art to say, why are we doing this? what is it for? What is a human? Why should we? And that's a story. It's not a statistic.
So I think it's almost like you've been reading my paper upside down, because the next question was whether we do confine art and imagination to too small a zone in our society.
We definitely do. And that I have to say that that's a huge worry. It's a huge worry that all of the arts are getting defunded. It's a huge worry that English departments everywhere are shrinking. I think part of it also is you English profs, some of whom are my best friends out there. You really need to be emphasizing how when the students are reading and analyzing these texts, they're actually reading and analyzing what's actually the meaning of being human and what the history of being human is, and that is what we need for the future, is more understanding of what being human means.
Todd Davies is our guest on The Exchange. He'll give a talk on the importance of story tomorrow at 4 at the Hannon Library at Southern Oregon University campus. Janet writes, Todd tells different stories through her cookbook memoirs. They not only describe wonderful meals, but great stories, too. So this gets us to the jam books. Tell us about the genesis of those.
Well, and also this gets us to my idea about everything should be about finding out what we are as humans, because I am a food expert. I love to talk about food. I'm from San Francisco, and my husband says everyone in San Francisco talks about the next meal at the meal they're eating, which is really true. I have to say it's totally true. My family does it. I mean, it used to drive my husband crazy, and I really knew that I had won when he started talking about what we were going to have for dinner and lunch one day. It was
perfect.
Really great. Yeah. So essentially what I did, and I'm very, very interested in cooking with what I have just in the refrigerator. I'm very interested in I'm just very interested in what food means to being a human and to communicating and to connecting with other people. For example, I love to eat with those that I love. And I have also found that when I can't work with somebody anymore, the first sign to me is I can't have lunch with them anymore. Uh-huh. So these things are important. I mean, they're sacred, actually. It's a sacred thing to have a meal with somebody.
Which is why it surprised me. You may be the first person to ever admit in public you like cooking for yourself.
Oh, gosh, I do. Oh, and the husband's away.
Is that because he's a vegetarian?
No. It's not because he doesn't mind if I eat meat. I mean, he did for the first few years that we were together. He would look at me and go, haven't you ever seen that movie, babe? You know, and then I would make pathetic noises that vegetables make and things, and we would amuse ourselves that way. But no, I like cooking for myself because it means that I can think about who I really am and what I really want. What do I really want at that moment? And it's not necessarily what you would think. I mean, the other night, I have to say an awful lot of people agree with me about this. And my husband does not like this. This has nothing to do with him being a vegetarian. I had popcorn for dinner. I love having popcorn for dinner. I love putting garlic salt on it. I love putting lots of butter on it. I love sitting there with it and a glass of wine. I just love that, right? So that tells me something about who I am. And the delight that I get from that tells me something about who I am. And think how inexpensive a pleasure that was, too.
You know, as I read just a little bit of the jam books in the previews that are provided on Google Books and realized, wait, this looks familiar. And then you mentioned Mary Frances Kennedy Fisher, MFK Fisher.
Oh, my heroine.
Thought, oh, there we go. You know, it's the same kind of thing where it's kind of a cookbook. You know, there's stuff that you could learn how to make in there, but more it's just sort of amusing on food.
Well, and also she was one of the great American writers. She was one of the great American writers of the 20th century, which she never got the cred because she was writing about food. This is another one of my themes, which is that things which are considered to be in the female realm tend to get less cred than things in what's considered to be the male realm. Not to say that men and women are on either side, but the culture looks at it that way. And I think that that's a mistake. I think we need to partner them up more.
All right, so The Importance of Story is the session tomorrow at 4 o'clock at the Hannon Library, brought in by the Friends of the Hannon Library. And which room? Do you know which room?
It's in the Meese room, which is on the third floor. And I'm supposed to mention free parking, free parking, free parking. So, and thank you very much to the Friends of Hannon Library, because it is an incredible group. And the Hannon Library is an incredible resource for the entire community. So everybody come, please.
Okay, that's tomorrow at 4 at the Hannon Library, Meese Room. Todd Davies, thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back, we'll talk about compost. Please stay tuned.